I'm here to talk to you today about a distributed system library that we built at Comcast called Sirius that we use for managing application reference data. I'm going to begin by talking about what we mean by reference data. So a reference data set is one where your application needs to have frequent access to it, but for which your application is not the primary system of record, right? So this is data that's available somewhere else, and from your application's point of view, your application really just has a read-only relationship with that data. Now, another characterization of the type of reference data that we're talking about is that the data set is largely static, meaning that the rate of updates to it is not very high with respect to the overall database. At the same time, we do care about seeing the updates, and we want to get them at some point. But again, because our application is at arm's length from the system of record, we can tolerate a little bit of propagation delay, right? So as the system of record is updated, we can tolerate a little bit of latency before it shows up at our application. In our case at Comcast, a major reference data set is the world of TV and movie entertainment metadata. So these are things like, what year did the movie, was the movie Casablanca released? Or how many episodes were in season 7 of Seinfeld? Or when is The Voice going to be on TV next, and on what channel? One of the things that we began to realize, especially fairly recently, is that as main memory sizes have been increasing for commodity application servers, this reference data set started to look like it was going to fit into memory. And in fact, when we started looking around, we found that, hey, there's a lot of reference data sets that are maybe not as big as we once considered them to be. So a good example is the encyclopedias that I actually show here. Anybody remember actually using the physical ones? So this is good in another sense in that, I don't know if you remember, but every year you would get like the yearbook that would come out at the end, which were the set of updates that had happened since the original encyclopedia was built. And so that's a good example of the update rate being relatively low with respect to the overall data set. So if I condense the Encyclopedia Britannica down to DVDs, this is only 4.2 gigabytes, right? So easily fits into main memory. We say, oh, well, that's well and good. This is ancient reference data technology, right? So let's look at something a little bigger. If I were to take all of the English language Wikipedia articles, download them in XML format, which of course is not the world's most concise data format. And in fact, not even compressed, right? So this is uncompressed XML. That's only 43 gigabytes. I can take my credit card and spin up an EC2 instance that has 6 times this RAM right now. So, and our reference data set that we were using is not even this big. So this led us to think about, hey, maybe there's a different application architecture we can be using for accessing this reference data set. So the traditional architecture here is that I have my application server with my business logic in it, and I've placed my reference data off in some external data store. And my application then issues queries to go fetch the reference data that it needs. Now, a familiar problem here is that there's an impedance mismatch, right? So my application wants to deal with native data structures, like objects, sets, maps, arrays, things of that sort. But the data is actually stored in a different format, right? Maybe it's laid out in documents in a NoSQL database, or laid out in a relational format in a traditional RDBMS. And so it's often the case that we add an object relational mapper to try to sort of mitigate that impedance mismatch. Now, anybody who's ever actually tried to tune the queries in production that one of these ORM layers generates might actually expand that acronym to obscuring the real mechanism. But either way, either with or without the ORM layer, our application developers have to spend their time thinking about the various failure scenarios that happen here, right? So I have to care about timeouts. I have to care about exceptions, cache misses, connection pool settings. These are all things that you have to pay a lot of attention to build a robust production service, but they are easy to forget to take a look at, and they're hard to get right. We began wondering if maybe there was a better way, because a lot of the effort here has nothing to do with the reference data set, and it certainly doesn't have very much to do with the application logic that we're trying to provide. So let's fast forward. So we have an application server. It has a large amount of memory with respect to this reference data set. The most convenient way to have access to the reference data is if it's actually just sitting in process in native data structures, right? Then I don't have to do any I/O to get access to it from my program. In this setting, now my application developers start to be concerned with the data structures and algorithms that you use for getting access to this data. They can write unit tests that don't require mock objects to sort of hide I/O while they're testing the application logic. And profilers actually become useful again, right? The traditional application server architecture is often I/O bound. So a profiler doesn't tell you very much about your application's performance. If the data is actually local and we're using the algorithms we learned in sort of our early CS classes, then we have an opportunity to apply some of these tools again. So what we set about doing was seeing if we could make this model real, right? So this is the model that we wanted to provide to developers. We wanted to make it easy for them to achieve this and to still keep this sort of mirror of the reference data set up to date. So one of the first things that we did was we inverted the relationship between the system of record and our application server. So instead of pulling data from the system of record, instead we turn that around and we publish updates into the application cluster. And this has the nice property that it decouples the availability of these systems. So if the system of record becomes unavailable for some point in time, it doesn't affect my application's availability. My reference data starts to become stale as I don't get updates coming in. But as I mentioned before, for a lot of these reference data sets, the application can really tolerate a lot of that latency for seeing those updates. So this ends up being a net win. So we produced this this library called Sirius. And the way that this works is it divides your application into sort of two rough components. So as an update gets published into the system, that gets published into sort of a particular interface that you provide in your application. So a lot of the places where we use this are in HTTP-based web services, right? So we define a specific endpoint where the updates can get published in. Application then turns around and hands that off to the Sirius layer. We model the updates as key value updates. So it's either a put of a value to a key or it's a delete, which disassociates any existing values from that key. The Sirius layer then turns around and talks to the Sirius library layer in the other members of the cluster. So it runs the Paxos protocol here to establish a globally consistent ordering and basically assign all of the update sequence numbers. In addition, it persists the updates as they come in to a local transaction log. So this transaction log, I'll talk about that in a moment, but this can be used to recover from application restarts. Once those two steps have completed, then the library turns back around and invokes an application-provided callback, which is a request handler. And so the idea is that here, the put or delete comes back to your application, and Sirius essentially says, now is the time to apply this to your in-memory copy. So essentially, it's very easy logic to see the updates coming in and then to update your native data structures. The transaction log, when the application starts, essentially just uses the same request handler to rebuild the data set from scratch, right? So Sirius just spools those updates back through the request handler to rebuild the in-memory mirror. Now, on the read path, we actually don't go through Sirius at all. So when an actual client request, and this is a request that's actually related to the functionality that the application has provided, when that comes in, we just read directly from the native data structures. So it doesn't involve Sirius at all. So as you might imagine, this means that we have eventual consistency around the reference data set, right? Because the reads don't go through the same sort of strong, consistent ordering that the updates do. We do get eventual consistency because all of the applications do apply the updates in the same order due to the sequence numbers that we're assigning. So what we typically do, as we said before, is so we have this this external system of record, that small guy off to the right-hand side, and it's publishing updates. We typically route those through a load balancer so that the external system doesn't have to know how many application servers are available. And so these run Paxos and assign the sequence numbers. And we typically use that for ingest. So we set up a cluster of server for ingest. Now, the Sirius layer also implements a catch-up protocol so that if a server is down for some period of time or it loses one of the update messages, there's a way to recover those lost updates. Because the sequence numbers are sequential, we know an application can tell when it's missing one. And so there's a protocol that's there for fetching missing updates from a peer node. So what this also lets us do is set up downstream dependent clusters that use that same catch-up protocol. But instead of participating in Paxos, they're just pulling the updates from the upstream cluster. And in fact, this can result in very flexible topologies. So you can actually chain different clusters to each other or have them branch out in a tree, for example. And so this is nice because of Paxos is a strong consistency protocol, there's pressure because the more machines that you add to that pool, the lower your throughput is, right? Which is, I mean, they have to agree. That's why it's a consensus protocol. On the other hand, we want to scale this out to serve lots and lots of users. And so by decoupling things in this fashion, we resolve that tension, right? Because we want a small number to get our ingest throughput up, but we want a large number to serve all the read sides. The last piece of bookkeeping that the Sirius library takes care of is managing that local transaction log. So as I mentioned before, we model these as key value updates. And so one of the things that we're able to do here is we're able to compact the transaction log because we just need the most recent update to any given key. And so the way that this works is we segment the transaction log. So as the updates are coming in, we're filling up segments to a maximum size, then starting the next segment, and so on. In the background, we come back around to the older segments, which are no longer being written, and we can go and compact them, right? So the first one may have multiple references to a given key, and so we can remove and just keep the last one. Similarly, we can move to the next segment and compact it with respect to all of the older ones as well. And so over time, while you're running, this compaction is going on in the background. And so if you do have an application restart, say for code deployment, then the set of data that's in the transaction log, it largely represents the most current version of the reference data set. Sirius is implemented in Scala using the ACCA actor system library. And this ended up being a very important choice for us. We chose the Paxos protocol because it is so well studied and understood in the literature, but we had not implemented it before. And so we based our implementation on a paper by Robert Vanreness called Paxos Made Moderately Complex. So this paper contains pseudocode for the algorithm that describes a bunch of cooperating processes. And it turned out that when we could very straightforwardly translate this into Scala and ACCA, where there's a very clear correspondence between the pseudocode in the original paper and this is the actual production code from the corresponding part in the library. There's a few additions. There was no mention of exception handling, for example. But in terms of understanding the basic logic, this was actually a very key design choice that we found. Just to wrap up, Sirius is currently being used by multiple services at Comcast. So we've had multiple internal development teams that have opted into using Sirius for managing the reference data sets. So it currently powers a number of things behind our next generation television experiences that run across set-top boxes, laptops, tablets, and things of that sort. We've been running it in production for almost 2 years now, and so it's been working really well for us. So in summary, the key contribution that Sirius provides is that it gives our developers access to the reference data in native arbitrary data structures. A lot of what we want our developers focusing their time on delivering new features or modifying existing ones. And so because so many of our features, especially in a television experience, have to deal with that reference data set of television of entertainment metadata, we want them to spend as little time as possible working on the plumbing behind that, right? So we want to make it very easy for them to have access to the data and test it and deliver new features. As I mentioned before, Sirius provides for eventually consistent replication. This is important from sort of an operational sanity point of view. Everybody likes to avoid divergent distributed systems. But the library itself handles persistence and replay. And so that That sort of bookkeeping and heavy lifting is taken out of the responsibility of the application developers. And it's available in a convenient library interface that has relatively transparent semantics. So as I mentioned before, as an application, you hand off a put or delete to Sirius, and then a put or delete comes back to you. So it's very easy to understand how the data flows through the system. Finally, we've actually open sourced our library, made it available on our GitHub account under an Apache 2 license. So we'd be very interested to hear everybody's feedback about that. And with that, I'm very happy to take any questions.
Hi, when you started talking about the main memory database, essentially, I started looking in trying to find this in the proceedings to see how it compared to related work, and I couldn't find your paper in the proceedings, and I was wondering if this is an accident or by intent, but the it's the one in the list of, you know, the program, all the other ones show the paper, and this one only links to the abstract, so is that just an accident?
I think that's just an accident. So when I went to the technical sessions on the website, our PDF of the paper is linked there.
Okay, it wasn't there 10 minutes ago.
Okay, well, so we can clearly take this offline. Right. I swear we wrote a paper.
Okay, so can you say something about the related work then?
Yeah, aside from
you mentioned Paxos, but what about all the other in-memory?
Yeah, there is a long related work section in the paper. You know, we tried to, as a good engineer will try to do, we tried to build on the shoulders of giants. So, a lot of the in-memory systems that we saw didn't have the exact set of design trade-offs that we were looking for. So a lot of them either still had that impedance mismatch, right? So if it's an embedded database, right, I still have the sort of query mismatch. I don't get my native data structures. Or it's held in an external process where I still have to manage either IPC or IO to go get it. We looked around, and there are a lot of things in this area. One of the key differences is that it's not just about holding things in memory for performance reasons. I mean, obviously, that beats, in many cases, going and doing I/O to get access to the data. But rather, it's a lot of our focus is around the convenience for the developers. And so having access in those native sets and maps and lists and arrays was sort of a big productivity win for us.
So one of your requirements, actually right here, is eventual consistency on servers, and you end up getting that with your two-layer GUI.
I'm sorry, with my two-layer what?
With your two-layer structure.
Oh, yeah.
Right. But why did you actually end up using Paxos rather than an eventual consistency protocol in the bottom layer?
Yeah, so one of the main reasons, again, that I mentioned that we chose Paxos, and work on this began several years ago. So, for example, it predates protocols like Raft, for example. This is a protocol that's very well studied in the literature. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Kyle Kingsbury. He's a developer at a startup in San Francisco, but he's been publishing a bunch of blog posts related to sort of distributed databases and how well they manage consistency. So we went with sort of the tried and true Paxos protocol. It could well be that an alternative protocol there was, is also possible. But here, this was one that was easy for us to reason about. If we run Paxos, it's very easy to understand, and we use that to assign sequence numbers. It's very easy to understand how we get eventual consistency out the other end. So that was one of our main motivations.
So good talk. I just had a question about the kind of the limits of the applicability here. It seems like there's a number of special properties for this application. It's a relatively small database. You can tolerate stale data, and the update rate seems to be fairly low. So, you know, given those constraints, yeah, I can see how, you know, you came up with this design, but I think it's worth keeping in mind that, you know, it's not in a different scenario where you say a higher update rate or need for, more timely data, that this wouldn't necessarily be applicable.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And so, you know, we don't we have plenty of other data sets ourselves that we don't manage this way.
Right.
And so we're very careful in the paper to lay out the parameters that, you know, we define as a reference data set where we think this is applicable.
Yeah.
So yes, while certainly not every data set would fall into that category, our feeling is that, and our experience has been, that there actually are lots of data sets that where this is applicable.
Yeah. Also, there's something wrong with my cable box at home. I don't know if you could drop by that or not.
So if you're serious, you should come talk to me afterwards. I might be too. Oops, sorry.